I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Attention all personnel. Please clear the launching area.
Fire, fire.
Oh, baby. I'll give it to you.
That was really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
Hello, welcome to Space Boffins, proudly stretching the definition of monthly podcast since 2011. It's our new logo. What's the phrase? Not logo.
Is it a brand?
New brand.
It's tagline.
Tagline, that's
sort
it. New
like
tagline.
That. Is it? Or,
no,
or,
tagline.
No, tagline's sort of written, isn't it?
No, I think tagline's
you
fine.
Think tagline?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or a new jingle. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists, and I'm Richard Hollingham.
And I'm Sue Nelson. It is worth the wait, though, with two big interviews, actually, to start the new year. Well, we can't really call it the new year now that we're in February, but it's sort of new for...
To continue the new year.
For our listeners, yes.
To continue the new year.
Yeah. In a moment, you're going to hear a great conversation with NASA astronaut Mike Massimino, chatting about what Apollo meant to him, the return to the moon, and Hubble.
And then, in a first for Space Boffins, the UK Government Science Minister, George Freeman, on launch, astronauts and the legacy of Apollo.
My brothers were 7 and 8 years older. The family was electrified. The country was electrified. I was 2, but I felt the kind of surge of electromagnetic emotional energy. And I think another generation will have the same thing when the Rosalind Franklin rover sends back those signals.
Mike Massimino, though, he's the veteran of 2 missions to the Hubble Space Telescope, which included 4 spacewalks.
Mike Massimino's reflection in the aft shroud of the Hubble Space Telescope as he prepares to open the doors, protective doors over the fixed head star trackers and the rate sensor units.
I think I should apologise for that clip because it makes it sound really boring, but it's actually awesome. Mike Massimino is reflected in Hubble.
Yeah, that's one of the things actually when maybe audio...
Those NASA
maybe
commentaries...
Maybe visuals do work a little bit better.
I went through that mission and as STS-135 and it's all a bit like that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't zing. But the visuals are stunning. So yeah. Take our word for it.
good. We will. Well, let's get on to Mike now. We've interviewed him before. This interview, you're in for a treat. That's all I can say. He's the first person, by the way, to tweet from space. And since retiring from that's not all he's known for, though,
no,
by
it's,
the way.
It's, what? It's the first thing on his website.
Oh, really?
His first
that's
sentence.
That's really weird. Oh, maybe,
first sentence
maybe
on his website.
Yeah, I suppose appeal to the younger fans, eh? And since retiring from NASA, he's appeared as a recurring character on The Big Bang Theory, which a lot of people probably will know him from, the sort of younger generation. He's written a book, he's hosted TV shows. He's also a professor at Columbia University in New York and senior advisor for space programs at the Intrepid Sea, Air and Space Museum there. And that's where we met him.
Yeah, we recorded this in November in his office on Intrepid, just ahead of the 50th anniversary of The Last Man on the Moon. So we started by talking about the Apollo program and what it meant to him.
My personal connection is that's what inspired me to want to go to space. I was 6 years old when they landed on the moon, the first mission, Apollo 11. I remember the build-up to that. And I idolized those astronauts. I wanted to grow up to be like Neil Armstrong, which really wasn't in the cards. I'm not a test pilot. I don't like heights. And I'm not really the typical thrill-seeking, heroic astronaut that you might imagine. But they inspired me to have an interest in the space program, which never left me, even though I was doubtful I could ever become an astronaut for most of my life. I always was interested in what they were doing, and decided it was really after college I decided that I wanted to try to make an effort, went back to grad school to be a part of the space program and to apply to be an astronaut. But the Apollo missions is what set it off. And it wasn't just the missions themselves and what they accomplished. I think it was the sense of camaraderie and teamwork. I felt what they were doing as a little boy. When I remember feeling very clearly, thinking very clearly that even at 6 years old, that this was the most important thing that has happened in hundreds of years. Back that time, we were learning about the explorers coming to the New World and other things in history. And I felt like what they were doing was the type of thing that 500 years from now, people would look back and say, this was the most significant thing about this time. And I still think that. I still think it's the most significant thing, certainly, that's happened in my lifetime. And I think it's the most significant thing that we'll accomplish in hundreds of years. I don't know when we're going to ever come close to topping what they did going to the moon for the first time. And Apollo 17 was the last of those missions, very significant. But by that time, interest started to fall off. Still a very interesting mission with a friend of mine now, Harrison Schmitt, who I just spoke to last week. He was the first geologist to fly in space for the specific reason to analyze and the geology on the moon and look for certain rocks. And that was a very significant mission, of course. And the first time they flew a true scientist in space in addition to a test pilot. So that was a breakthrough mission for a few reasons.
Isn't that extraordinary that you became an astronaut and one of your friends flew on one of those missions that you were following as a child?
Yeah, he wasn't my friend back then. He's become my friend since. And it's really weird, you know, when I think about it.
You're not his stalker, are you?
No, I was at my in-law's house a few months ago in Atlanta, and the phone rings, and I see Harrison Schmitt on it. So I got to take this. I was like, wow, you know, this is really really quite interesting. But I've gotten to know a lot of the moonwalkers. I got to know Neil Armstrong a bit. Alan Bean, who was the fourth person on the moon, became a mentor of mine and a great friend. I miss him very much. He died a few years back. Charlie Duke, who was on Apollo 16, wonderful guy. I've gotten a chance to become friends with him. John Young was still an astronaut when I was when I was first started. So John Young was also on Apollo 16. Was also on Apollo 10 when they flew close to the surface right before Apollo 11, and first commander of the space shuttle and one of the I think most accomplished astronaut ever is John Young. We're really an interesting guy, a very very good astronaut and pilot, and dedicated his whole life. Never left NASA. Continued to be an active astronaut through his 60s. And was still an active astronaut when I showed up at NASA in 1996. So I got to work with him and fly in the jet with him several times and got to know him pretty well. So, yeah, it's kind of wacky when these people who are my heroes, Gene Kranz, I'm friends with him. Well, these people that were my heroes, I became friendly with. And those that are left, still am in touch with. So, yeah, pretty special.
What do you, when you're thinking back to your childhood, what do you feel when that was the last mission? Then 17 was the last mission. Were you as excited about Shuttle and Skylab?
No, I wasn't. In fact, I can't. So in 1972, when that mission occurred, I was 10 years old. I kind of knew what was happening, but I think much like a lot of the country, I'd kind of moved on a bit. And for me, I think it was, personally, I never thought I could become an astronaut like Neil Armstrong or Harrison Schmitt or any of those guys. I just didn't think that was possible. And my neighborhood where I grew up, you know, there was no astronauts walking around. There weren't very many, I think, anywhere else either. But I was just like, this can't happen. By that point, I was like into sports and trying to do my best in school and my friends and having fun and doing those things. And so the space program kind of faded for me for a while. Even though I was interested in math and science and studied engineering, I still wasn't thinking about NASA until I became a senior in college. I went to see this movie, The Right Stuff, which is based on a book by Tom Wolfe. And I saw the movie and I read the book, and that got me thinking again. And I started looking into what was going on at that time, which was now the space shuttle program in the mid-1980s, and started realizing that it wasn't just military test pilots and that maybe this is something that I could at least attempt. Not that they would ever pick me, but at least I could maybe submit an application if I got some more credentials, and that's the way that works. So it wasn't that I wasn't excited. It just, I never really thought I could ever be a part of it. And then when I got re-inspired with the movie The Right Stuff, seeing that and the book with it, I started thinking about what might be possible. So I wasn't really that, I guess, like, by the time Apollo 17 was going, I wasn't as passionate about it as I was as a six-year-old.
Were you intimidated slightly by the test pilots? Because both of us have read the book, seen that film.
Yeah.
We know from having interviewed some of the Apollo astronauts ourselves, mm-hmm. that particularly, well, you did that with Gene Cernan. They're a terrifying lot. Yeah. They can be quite intimidating.
The worst interview I've ever done was with John Young.
Really? With John Young? Why? What happened?
Well, I wanted him to enthuse about being on the moon, and he wanted to talk about computers.
What did he... Yeah, John, he wasn't... Yeah, boy, oh boy. Yeah, so he... So John was great, but I asked... When I was a new astronaut, I was flying with him. And I got to know him. There was this one, he would fly from Houston to ride our simulator, the vertical motion simulator in California. And it was an Ames Research Center in California. And, when I first got to NASA, you say, was I intimidated? It was really strange. Once I became an astronaut, I felt like I was part of the club or something. And then I could talk to these guys, and they were interested in talking to me. And it was really weird because... Well, John was still an active astronaut, but I got to know him. I interviewed twice. I was rejected my first time. So I met him that first time that I interviewed, and then I got interviewed again, and then I was picked. He was the head of the selection board both of those times. And so he knew who I was, and he didn't stop me from being selected. So I figured, he must kind of like me, I guess. And he did. He was great, and I would seek out advice from him. And one of the first things I did when I got there, we're flying in a T-38, it was where our training was, and then once we were qualified to do that, I was qualified as a backseater. I couldn't fly as a pilot in command in the front, but John Young was qualified in the front, so right after I got my qualification, I said, John, anytime you need someone in your backseat, I'd love to go, and probably about like 3 days later, he said, Mike, I'm going down to the Cape to check some stuff out, you want to come? I'm like, yes, and he goes, are you clear that day? I go, I don't know, and if I'm not, I will be, So I was able to go and do a few different flights with him. And there was this one, after about maybe the third time, maybe this was like the third time I was flying with him, we were spending a whole day going out to Ames Research Center. And he did these flights in one. So it was three flights there and three flights back. So we stopped in El Paso, Las Vegas, and then we go to Moffett Field, California, ride the simulator, and then do that whole thing in reverse and come back in one day. That's a lot of flying, a lot of time. We had to leave really early, got back at night. But I got to spend a whole day with this guy. I was in the simulator with him, too. I mean, I was by his side the whole time, pretty much. And on the way back, I asked him, he started telling me, I got him going on stories about what it was like in the early days and, what they did during selection, some of the experiments they did with these guys and what it was like, so a little bit of the notoriety they had. And then I finally asked him, what was it like on the moon? And I was expecting some really interesting answer. And he said to me, he goes, well, Mike, the best thing about... What he more or less told me is the best thing about it, you could finally go to the bathroom. Because, when you get... And he goes, you don't know this yet, but when you're in zero gravity, things aren't working like they're supposed to. And you need a little bit of gravity to help with your digestion. We have since learned that, and there are things you can do with supplements and so on to make that a little bit easier. But back then, this was in the early days of the space program, and I guess they hadn't figured all that out yet. So when he got to the moon, he said he finally could...
I think we got the picture.
And I was like, wow, that's really something. But I think that's kind of understated of the way those guys, were about what they were doing. I think they almost had to be that way. There was an element of the job, if you've seen to refer to another space movie, First Man, there's an element of that job that was all about the business of it. Not the financial business that we think of sometimes, but, taking care of doing your job. And, you couldn't get distracted, and in some ways, you couldn't just had to really stick to what you were doing. If you didn't, you wouldn't be successful, and it required you to really throw yourself into the job and into the work you were doing. And it wasn't very glamorous at that level. It was a lot of hard work and late nights and rough on the family and all that stuff. But it required that. It really required that you put your all into it. And I think that's what they were more concerned with. They were more concerned with the execution of the mission than anything else. And so even, I guess, also the romance of it too, or what people might think, I think you could get a bit overwhelmed by the magnitude of what you're trying to accomplish. So I think that's maybe the way it was for a lot of those guys.
Has it given you an appreciation, knowing these people, but also having been an astronaut, also having serviced Hubble? I noticed in the NASA website, you're described as a veteran Hubble astronaut. Because the challenge of going to the moon, and now we're looking at Artemis, because maybe people don't appreciate how difficult this is.
I think the difficulty with what they were doing, and what even what we were doing with the shuttle in some respects, not to downplay what's going on now, what they're doing now is extraordinary, but what they did with Apollo especially, they didn't have much help with computers or anything that we have now where automatic systems. We had a little bit of that on the shuttle, not much, but the pilots needed to fly and land the shuttle. It was all manual flying and landing. But with Apollo, all that stuff going on the moon and back, they didn't have any computing power at all, really, compared to today's standards. What we have in an antiquated cell phone is more than what they had on board that spaceship. So it required a lot of training. It was quite dangerous. Even the training itself, they had crashes with this lunar landing vehicle that they were practicing with. There was an ejection that happened with Neil Armstrong was almost killed in that thing before he was assigned, I think, to Apollo 11. It was quite dangerous. It was quite reliant on the training and the abilities of those pilots. So they didn't have much help in the way of computing. And that was also for the ground team. The ground team, who was there to help them at every second, they didn't have much help with computers or technology back then either. I mean, what they had was much better than what they had 10 years earlier back in the 50s, I guess. But compared to what we have now, it's not even close. So like, there was a much different way of doing things. And when you consider that they were able to accomplish what they did, was just extraordinary. That they got all the way there and all the way back and landed and got off the moon. And you know, they weren't so sure. I remember hearing them talk about Neil Armstrong and Mike Collins saying as well that they thought the chances of pulling off Apollo 11 100% was about 50-50. I remember Mike Collins saying that he certainly thought he had a much better chance of coming back alive than those other two guys, Neil and Buzz, because they had the added problem of blasting off from the moon. That was another launch that they had to withstand. That was powered flight. And if the rocket doesn't end, you know, it could end badly, or you might not get it to work. But unlike on Earth, if you have it, it doesn't look like a good day and you can shut down the engine, you don't have that luxury on the moon. Those guys would have been stranded there. So he thought that the chances of them pulling it all off was 50-50. Alan Bean, my friend, who was on Apollo 12, I learned from him that Apollo 11, Apollo 12, and Apollo 13 were designed as exactly the same mission. So he was training to do exactly what they were going to do on Apollo 11, as were the guys on Apollo 13. The reason was they didn't know if they were going to be successful on Apollo 11. So they thought, all right, maybe we'll be successful, maybe not, but we're not taking any chances. We're going to have all three of these crews trained for the exact same flight. And then once Apollo 11 was successful, they had to get a completely new mission planned for Apollo 12, which they didn't have very much time at that point to plan it, but they did and were successful with that mission as well. But that's the way they were looking at it. They were, to us, I mean, you know, when you see, even like with the Artemis mission, you know, we think, oh, everything's going to go fine. And then, well, no, we're not launching today. You know, that's the way it's perceived by people, that is, you just walk out to the launch pad and you go. And that's the way I thought when I was a kid seeing those guys on Apollo 11. But I think they knew and they did know, and everyone who was affiliated working on that mission knew that it might not work the way we think it's going to work today, but it did.
How do you feel about Artemis? Do you think we're sort of picking up almost where, you know, when you were 10, Apollo 17, mm-hmm. that was the last mission. Do you feel we're sort of picking up now, going back to the moon? Are you excited about that?
Yeah, I am. I was with a couple of the delays we've had, and it has been delayed for years, actually, if you look at when they were hoping to launch. But once it went, I started getting excited again. I don't know if I really let myself get excited because I wasn't sure if they were actually going to launch. But once they did, I was like, it's pretty cool. And I think what's hopeful about it is that not only do we have a rocket that can get there, but now there's a spacecraft that hopefully will check out. I mean, that's the bigger issue almost. It's really two things. One was the launch vehicle, and also how that spacecraft itself performs. There's no one inside, but they'll be taking data and radiation protection and how well it does. It's going to be up there for quite long. It won't be coming back until December 11th. So it's going to be about 26 days in space. So we'll see how it performs. That'll be good to hear about that. Hopefully it'll do well. But the larger picture is going back, not just to land people to look around, but landing and moving from this point forward with the purpose of settling on the moon The next mission will be, I would say, like a checkout of the spacecraft and the scenario of launch and the spacecraft going to the moon. They're going to have four crew members on that one is the plan. I think we should be hearing about who those people are going to be shortly after they get the conclusion, the splashdown of the current mission. So for Artemis 2, I think they would assign that crew fairly soon after that. I don't know if they're going to do that, but I would imagine that's going to be the case. And then that crew will do a lap of the moon and come back. I would look at that as more like another test flight. And then the next mission after that, they're actually going to land. But they're landing. The plan to land is pretty interesting. It also involves, at this point, SpaceX, I think, that's going to be launching the Starship there. And they have a lander that's going to land on. So they're going to rendezvous with this thing. And then they're going to land with this commercially provided vehicle and then do some exploring down there, particularly at the south pole of the moon, to look for water. So the reason you're looking for water, because you're planning at some point to stay there for a while, and so water is needed, of course, for life, but also for fuel. And if we could find water there, that could be a significant finding. Not just finding it, but what is it like, and how can we process, and how can we use it? Use it to keep life, keep people alive, but also to use it as fuel, perhaps, to go further to Mars and maybe beyond someday. So it's not just to see that we could do it, and the objectives are different than what it was 50 years ago. Now we're trying to get there. International cooperation is going to be a big thing here, and also cooperation with commercial companies. So I think it's a much different model with much different goals. So it is, I think, using what we learned, I guess, from those Apollo missions and trying to build on it to stay this time. I think of it much like polar exploration about 100 years ago, when people would get to whoever got to the South Pole first, and then they kind of just went home. And really, we didn't go back in with a lot of effort again to go and explore and stay there until about 50 years later. I mean, people kept going back for visits, but to actually set up a research station took about 50 years. So I think we're kind of, looks like maybe on a similar schedule to setting up a research station, a place to explore, look for commercial possibilities on the moon about 50 years later, 50 years after the last mission.
John Glenn famously got a second chance to go into space. Mm-hmm. If you were offered a second chance to go to the moon, would you take it?
I don't know. Maybe.
I didn't expect that.
I don't know. I mean, so I would, and that would be great. To go to the moon, certainly, but it's not going to happen. They have, I think I'll know a lot of the people that are going to be going, but, so part of it is like, why worry about something that's not going to happen? So I don't see why in the world they would send me to the moon at this point. I haven't been with NASA for 8 years, and they've got a lot of good people. Yeah, I remember speaking to John. One of the things I asked John Young about, if he ever would want to fly. We were in El Paso taking a break during one of these flights, and I asked him as we were taking his break, "Hey, John, do you ever think about flying again? It'd been a long time. I guess his last mission was maybe 12 or 14 years earlier." So I asked him, and he looked at me and he goes, "No, Mike, it's your turn. It's your turn, Mike." And I'll never forget that. And I think the same way, that it's a turn for these other people. I had my opportunity. I'm very happy to get to do what I did. Sure, I'd like to fly on the moon, go to the moon. Sure, I would not turn that down. So the answer to your question, yes, but I don't know. Christmas is coming up. I don't think Santa Claus is giving away moon flights. But certainly, yes. I mean, if I had a chance to go to the moon, I would jump at it, sure. But I don't think anybody's going to do it any asking. But if they do, I'll go.
Let me just ask you a couple of questions about Hubble and the James Webb Space Telescope. You were one of the last people to repair Hubble, to touch Hubble. Isn't it fantastic? It's still working. And with the James Webb Space Telescope at the same time, so you've got these two space telescopes working simultaneously, which is really the dream, isn't it?
Yeah, get as many as you can. Just because we had Hubble, we didn't shut down our Earth-based telescopes. I mean, Earth-based telescopes still provide lots of great data and imaging and information about understanding the universe. The imaging of the black hole that it came out, I guess, a while back here, the first one, and they found one in our galaxy as well. That was done with ground-based telescopes cooperating. So I think Hubble had something to do with it, but we still, we not like we threw everything away. You know, it's still making new ones too on the to use on Earth that are very powerful. So you didn't throw all those away because you had Hubble, and you're not going to throw Hubble away just because you have James Webb. So, yeah, I think it's a great thing that they're right now they're both working.
What's your feeling now about Hubble and its longevity? Because there's been talk now of actually repairing it again, or at least you know having another, you know, keeping it going as long as possible.
I'm interested to see how that's going to turn out. Now with, I think you're referring to, there's a private space company, Jared Isaacman, who's I've become friends with, a great guy. He more or less chartered a SpaceX vehicle to do some orbits around our planet for a few days. He didn't go to the space station, but did get to space. And now his next plan, his next hope is to go again to space with a different set of people that he would bring along with him. And they're going to try to do a spacewalk, I guess, on this next mission. And then one of the things he wants to do is go to Hubble and see what he can do to help there. You can reboost it. That, I think, should be pretty straightforward. But opening it up and starting to do some repairs or replacements of things, that's a different story. I don't know about that. I mean, it's definitely possible. I don't think there's any reason why they cannot. But that's a much different undertaking. They were very difficult spacewalks, very complex. I'm not saying it can't be done, but it's going to require a lot of effort, a lot of training, and I would think. But you're also going to be creative about it, too. We looked at one point when our Hubble mission was canceled. I wasn't on the mission yet, but after the Columbia accident, they canceled the mission to Hubble for quite a while. It was about a year and a half until they got put back on the books. We started looking at it again. I guess it was about a year or so after that mission was canceled. But in the meantime, we started looking at how to do it robotically. And so there was limitations on what we could do, but we had a plan. It was some things we could have attempted. It just ended up being too expensive. So I think that kind of creative thinking, doing it maybe with different spacesuits or different tools that they would have available to them, I think there might be a way to do it. I wouldn't say no, that it can't be done, but that's a bit difficult. I'm hopeful they were able to do it. I think it's definitely worthwhile, but we'll see. NASA is very protective of that telescope. At least they were when we were touching it. And, you know, it's working right now. So the number one rule we had was do no harm. And, you know, if the thing's not working, what the heck? You know, it's not working. But right now it's working. So they certainly would want to make sure they couldn't harm it. But I hope they can do it. I think there are ways to do it. I think they're... it's not beyond the realm of possibility, and I hope I do hope there is another mission to service Hubble.
You've written about, you know,
that's one I would definitely sign up for. But we'll see. happens.
That was my question. Do you still have an attachment, like an emotional attachment to Hubble? You know, as someone who's touched it, worked on it, grappled with it, broken tools, trying to fix it.
Yeah, I do. I think what I really admired. I think the telescope itself is a telescope, which is cool, amazing. But really what made it work and what continues to have it work are the people that built it and look after it and the scientists, the astronomers that use it. That's kind of what I miss. I mean, that more than anything is what I miss. And I remember saying that I was a first-time flyer assigned to be a spacewalker on Hubble. It was the first time they ever did that. And I remember talking to Alan Bean about that, that I felt he was, I was the second luckiest first-time space flyer since Alan Bean. Because Alan, on his first mission, got to walk on the moon, and I got to spacewalk on Hubble. And I really felt that way. It was really fortunate, mainly because of the people involved. They were great people all over NASA, but this team was really special, the way that they were able to come up with new ways to service the telescope and keep it going and repair the instruments. We did things we never thought we could do when it came down to that last mission. So I certainly do have a connection and an affection for the telescope, but I think it's more the team behind it, the people that are still there. A lot of them have retired now, but a lot of them are still there working it and working on other things too. And then the astronomers there's a lot of new ones, but a lot of those folks I work with are still at it as well. And they're great teams of people. So, yeah, I do have a connection to it, and I'm always ready to help in any way I can, whether it's in space or on the ground. More likely on the ground now, but certainly would be very happy to help.
Mike Massimino, and thanks to the Intrepid Sea, Air and Space Museum in New York for hosting us. I mean, I know they were really helpful. They were great. It is a brilliant museum, and we actually have more from the museum on the shuttle they have. We'll
with a brilliant
do that in the
curator,
next few months,
really
at
good
some point.
Speaker as well. So we've got that to come as well.
It's well worth a visit.
Wasn't Mike great? Because
he was brilliant, really relaxed.
He was good last time on the podcast, and that was quite a few. It was pre-COVID. It was quite a few years ago. He was good, but not.
He didn't connect last time. He relaxed, hadn't he? I thought so. I didn't feel we had a connection last time.
No.
It was a slightly awkward interview. It was fine. It was not as good as I would have liked it. This time, I really zinged. He was absolutely fantastic. Very relaxed.
Very funny as well.
Yeah, and he vindicated me. I felt so much better when I told about John Young. I felt it so much better that it wasn't just me that got the poor interview. It was John Young. Just tell our dear listener... what you said after the interview.
I just can't remember now. I just can't remember. I do remember it being excruciatingly embarrassing.
The situation, the atmosphere suddenly went awkward.
I mean, it was something, I think it was when, because obviously when you're doing radio, people don't realise, and particularly when you're doing it, as opposed to, say, a podcast where you could be across the table from somewhere. When you were, we were doing it with our radio equipment, we're close.
Yeah.
Your arm's length to somebody. Sometimes your knees are touching. We're close. So it just suddenly, I just looked at him and realised he was just really attractive. And I do have one of those brains where... as Richard says to me, please use your inside voice only. You know, don't use your inside. Where things that are in my brain just come out without me realising it, which is why I said to him, "You're something along the lines of, you're really very attractive."
You said he looked like a Greek god.
Oh, okay.
That's what you said.
He did. Actually, I was thinking Roman because he's obviously Massimino Italian. So I was thinking of those sort of Roman statues because he has got those beautiful sort of big almond eyes, shaped eyes. And I said he did remind me of a Greek girl.
So.
And yes, he did look awkward.
It did get suddenly the room couldn't have been because felt very, very small.
I didn't mean to do that. But, it tickled the press officer who was in the room with us, because afterwards I'm pretty sure she said, actually, he was secretly pleased, though, afterwards, because he still posed for a few photos.
Yes.
Although
he did, it was
there
next
was a
to
little
me,
bit of a distance.
Not you.
sort of thing. Yeah. So that was, okay.
And since has a restraining order.
Yes.
Anyway, Mike Massimino, great. He was absolutely brilliant. Lovely insight into Apollo there. Great insight into John Young. And
the Greek god of the NASA astronaut corps.
And I would love to see Hubble serviced, but I don't want anyone to just mess with it. I think it's got to be done. It's got to be done properly. But right now it's working, so leave it alone. So coming next, an interview with the UK's science minister on astronaut space debris and the disappointment of Virgin Orbit's failed launch. You'll be pleased to hear that Sue wasn't present in the room for this interview. This is Space Boffins. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists.
Oh dear, I have actually interviewed a number of science ministers in the past, particularly in my one of my former jobs at the BBC. And I don't think I accosted any of them, although David Willetts...
There's always an although, isn't there?
When David Willetts was a science minister, he was known as the man with two brains because he was so clever. Whether he really is so clever or that's just compared to a politician, you know, who knows? But he does seem incredibly nice, incredibly bright. And I brought our son with us because he'd... I think it was school holidays and the only time they could get an interview was during half term and... I think our son was probably about 10 or something, and I couldn't, there was no club I could put him to. I tried a few friends and parents, and they were like, oh, they were all on holiday. So I asked the government and said, is it okay if I bring my child with me? And they said yes. And while I didn't accost him, he couldn't have been nicer, to the point where he was actually the opposite of Mike Massimino. Well, similar in that he spent, his attention was more on the sun than me. I had to sort of drag him away. He showed him a little spacecraft that he had on his desk, one of those tiny little CubeSats. He talked to him about space and, yeah, he was really nice. But, yeah, he kept his distance. I wonder why. No, thinking about it. Anyway, by the way, you can find us all over the place on social media.
Yeah, we need to update that.
Yeah, so well, actually, all over the place. Now, there's another. There's
exactly.
A catchphrase we could have. We are all over the place. Yes,
it's more words than one.
All over the place. So do get in touch via Facebook or Twitter. All comments, thoughts and suggestions gratefully received, including how I can use my inside voice just a little bit more. We also have this huge archive, 10 years worth of podcasts.
11 years worth.
Yeah, that. Oh, yes, of course. I keep forgetting.
11 and a half.
2023.
Yeah, it is.
So actually, it's almost 12 years worth. In July, it would be 12. That's amazing.
That's why I said 11 years at the top of the podcast.
But it's actually 12, isn't it?
No, it's 11 and a half.
Okay. Yeah, okay. 2011. But it's 2023, Rich.
Yes, but it's only the beginning of 2023. 2011
is,
yes, but it will be 12. Yes, only if it's the summer, because that's when we started doing them. We started doing them the summer
of 2011.
11, yeah. So this coming summer will be 12 years. Okay. So it's 11 and a half at the moment.
Okay. Anyway, I was talking about the archive before we got into a very... Hey, space boffins, we're all over the place. Here we go. It works. It works for me already. Yeah, there's tons of people on there. Space scientists, engineers, loads of astronauts. We've had actually that great musician from public service.
We've got a brilliant podcast on public service broadcasting. Because we were one
poets.
Of the... Yeah, we were one of the first people to really sort of, well, not discover public service broadcasting, but out there.
That's stretching it, Rich.
Yeah, but we did a lot with them.
We championed it right away. Absolutely. We were on them, weren't we?
We were on them.
And he was great because
he was brilliant. I went to his recording studio.
Yeah, he was fabulous. Yep. He's got a great, crazy name, hasn't he? Like Wild Goose. Is it Wild Goose? It is, isn't it? Wild Otter.
Oh, no, I can't remember.
Wilder Goose? Wilder Badger?
Yeah, no,
I'm sure it is.
It's really bothering me now.
Wilder Otter.
No, because I know his proper name.
Wild Camel.
Look, just carry on.
All right, and you're going to come back. Yeah. I put money on it being...
It's Wild Goose, I think.
Wilder Goose or Wilder Goose or something like that. Anyway, yeah, so check out the... this is just a very long-winded way. Space boffins, we're all over the place, of saying, you know, check out that archive.
J. Will Goose, Esquire.
Will Goose, there you go. Not Wild Goose. That's just me thinking it was Wild Goose, isn't it?
Look, just carry on.
All right, we're supported by the UK Space Agency, which means we can cover more UK space than pretty much other space podcasts, not least because we get some great access. And so... this is a first for space boffins, though, because it's the current UK Science Minister, George Freeman.
Now, I met him in Parliament in one of the quite grand committee rooms in Portcullis House. Before we hear a conversation, I should say that editorially, all the questions are my own. There was no pressure to avoid particular areas, particular questions. So the interview is also largely unedited. So I thought you'd like to hear it as it was.
So it's
the
not
whole
a
conversation.
Promo. That's what
it's
we're saying.
It's not a promo for the government. This is, you know, what
journalism
is, this is what I asked and what he said. I've just tidied it up a little bit in the edit. We'll talk about launch, the new British astronauts, the UK's participation or not in the European Union's Copernicus Earth Observation Programme, saving ESA's mission to Mars, and space debris.
George Freeman, UK Minister for Science, Research, Technology and Innovation, with responsibility for space.
You don't want to call yourself the Space Minister?
I'd love to. Titles have to be clear with number 10, and part of my aim as the Minister for Space Sector in the UK is to get it to a point where it's recognised as a major industry. I was Minister for Life Science, Minister for Agritech, I hope there will be in due course a minister for space, because it's such an exciting sector.
Well, we'll come on to that. I think we need to start, though, with the sad failure of the first launch from the UK. Well, I mean, it started well. The 747 Cosmic Girl took off, first stage went okay, and then the launch failed. There was so much, or seemed to be so much, riding on this.
Yes, it was a huge moment, and there was an awful lot going on that night. For the UK, we were, I mean, of course, in the end, the mission was a failure in terms of the launch of the satellites, and I don't want to, pretend otherwise. But, we became the first country in Europe to do space launch. They did get into orbit. Wasn't the right orbit, but they got into space. We have a spaceport now, the first European regulated spaceport in Europe, in Cornwall, two more coming in Scotland. All of the regulatory work, there was a lot to do. We'd established all the regulatory frameworks for launch successfully. And as you say, 9/10 of the operation from Virgin all worked. But of course, space is hard, right? And the first ESA missions didn't work. I mean, we've all been here. But we are absolutely committed to commercial payload satellite launch and the LEO market. And we're pretty sure Virgin will be back quite soon. We're now working to make sure we can get some more satellites ready for the next launch.
Now, you mentioned when you introduced yourself the importance of space. Quite a commitment at the Ministerial Council to space. I've read it's a record commitment from the UK. Does that mean space is a big priority for the government?
Yes, it's a huge priority. I was 15 years in tech venture capital before coming to Parliament 12 years ago, and I've led the first life science strategy and then the agri-tech industrial strategy and the transport strategy. Prime Minister's now put me in charge of all of UK science research, tech and innovation. It's a huge budget. It's about 40 billion over this 3 years. And space is the sector we see at the head of a list of sectors growing fast. We're already in the UK. We have a £16 billion sector, 45,000 employees. I've likened the UK sector to a kind of Formula One pit lane. We've got companies like Astroscale and Surrey Satellites and Inmarsat and Reaction Engines and Space Force. We've got some amazing companies, but we haven't had a prime and we haven't had launch. Airbus is here, which is huge, but of course it's a Franco-German company with a UK operating arm. It's a huge player in the UK, but our ambition is to grow into a bigger commercial sector. So space is a huge growth area for us. Over the next 10 years, my goal is to turn this increase in our public R&D into 2, 3, 4x private investment from industry, and the space sector is clearly poised to deliver. My job is to get the policy framework right, and basically that means, ESA, the European Space Agency, we made a big contribution, just short of 1.8 billion. We put more in, and we got everything we were looking for, 15-odd programs, from deep science, space science, which the UK has always been a big party to much nearer commercial projects. But also through the Space Agency, then in the UK, we're putting in another 1.5 odd billion, and the MOD are putting in this 3 years, 3 billion. So it's about a 7 billion commitment over 3 years. We're doing it because we think this sector is ready.
Let's talk about that. You mentioned the science. ExoMars was the big question mark. This particular meeting, can it be saved? It was a joint European-Russian mission, now solely a European mission, and it can be saved, can it?
Yes, it was one of the absolutely key things for me and Paul Bate, CEO of the Space Agency, on our list of things that we wanted in ESA. We really wanted to get the Rosalind Franklin mission back on track, and I'm really thrilled we've done it. I think it'll be one of those moments where a whole generation is electrified by, the rover on Mars drilling in and giving us a readout of what it finds. I remember, so I was born in 67, I remember an electrifying moment of energy in my first 2 years, which I realized later was the Apollo launch and moon landings. My brothers were 7 and 8 years older. The family was electrified. The country was electrified. I was 2, but I felt the kind of surge of electromagnetic emotional energy. And I think another generation will have the same thing when the Rosalind Franklin rover sends back those signals. And the fact that it will have been manufactured here in the UK is a huge moment and a big signal that we're still committed to deep space science, as well as the near market satellite launches, the commercial sector, the regulation, the insurance.
I mean, that is quite exciting, isn't it? Because we've seen the buzz internationally around the NASA Mars missions, most recently Curiosity, Perseverance. Mm-hmm. So you're anticipating a similar thing with this British built. We've seen it being built in the clean room in Stevenage, yeah. And the same with this British built rover.
It's a really important project for us for several reasons. Partly, space is the big frontier, and so many of the clues to the creation of our planet, its sustainability, the solar system, solar flares, climate change, so much of that deep science is deeply relevant to our planet. But also, it's deep in the core DNA of humanity to quest, to discover, to explore. And the deep oceans and deep space, but particularly deep space, it captures, I think, a defining element of humanity, whether you're Chinese, Russian, American, or wherever you are in the world, it touches the very essence of being human. And I think that's really important. It unites the world. The space station circulating the planet with scientists, researchers from all around the world is an inspiring thing. So we're deeply committed to that. But to help pay for it and to help grow our economy, we're really committed to the commercial aspect. This is a win-win, I think.
Now, the other area that the UK has been very good at is Earth observation over the years, and climate science, weather, all those sorts of areas. The UK was part of Copernicus, the EU Earth observation program. It was also part of Galileo. The UK is out of that, the navigation program. Where are we at with Copernicus and UK involvement in essentially a European Union mission that's provided by the European Space Agency? It's a little bit complex, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I know you've got listeners all around the world who won't be following the minutiae of Anglo-European Brexit politics. So when we negotiated to leave the European Political and Monetary Union, single currency, single flag, single integrated Europe, we specifically negotiated not to leave the science, the research, all these other programs. We're proud to be members of the European Community of Nations. We just wanted to be outside the political union. That was 2 years ago. Our association to those three programs, Horizon, Copernicus, and Euratom, has been blocked because of high politics to do with Northern Ireland and the EU, and which is a shame. I mean, science sort of being weaponized. But on those three, I have been very clear that the money we would have put in to the European programs is ring-fenced, and we've spent this last year urging the European Union to allow us back in, and we've got huge support. Every European member state wants us in. Everyone I speak to, it's just politics. And so we've committed. Earth observation is a hugely important sector. We've made a big commitment, about $450 million over this 3 years to Earth observation. We committed to those programs through ESA. We're not in Copernicus, but ESA still has relevant programs, so we pile in on those, and we're putting 150 odd million through the Space Agency. It's an absolutely key platform for us. Just on the others, on Euratom, we're in a similar place. We've deployed the money, and we're looking for international partners as we industrialize fusion. And on the big Horizon budget, that's 14 odd 15 billion into the European research program over 8 years. We're blocked. And I've made very clear, look, if we can't play in the European Cup of Science, we'll play in the World Cup. And so we're going to deploy those budgets in all sorts of ways around the world. So we are absolutely determined to continue the tradition of Great Britain as a force for international science.
But you wouldn't, if these can get, as you say, unblocked, could the UK become a part of the Horizon programme and the Copernicus programme?
Yeah.
Like you say, without getting into the Northern Ireland politics of all this, because there's a lot going on right now.
Yeah, I've been really clear. We're not slamming the door. We're not pulling the phone out. That really dates me, doesn't it? The days when phones had wires, right? We're leaving the door open, signalling loud to Europe. Look, we really want to come in, but I can't allow world-class researchers to be benched and watch others playing on the field. And so, ideally, I hope that as we move to deploy and show that we're not going to hang around, I hope Europe will pick up the phone. But either way, we are absolutely committed to make sure that the great tradition of Earth observation science in the UK will not suffer. And there's a huge international market from Canada to Australia, all around the world. People really respect our science and our research and our industry. So we're determined to support it.
Let's talk about astronauts now. In fact, let me just throw in here, and I've mentioned this several times on the podcast. When I first started covering space in the UK, whether this was for the BBC or whether it was for the British National Space Centre, what became the UK Space Agency, I edited the magazine called Space UK. It was very clear to me when I started editing this magazine that there were to be no mention of astronauts and certainly no mention of rockets. And now we're talking about both and with the minister. So potentially three astronauts from this latest selection. One will almost definitely become an astronaut, Rosemary. John McFall, para-astronaut, or however they're going to call that. And then
Megan.
Christian one of the next sort of stage down. So, I mean, that's incredible, isn't it?
It is, and I think it's a great moment for the UK. Again, this was something I went to the European Space Agency Council of Ministers with the agency. It was absolute red line for us. And that's why we put a bit more money in. We were on the front foot supporting the European Space Agency. It's not the EU. It involves international partners, and we wanted to signal our continued commitment. Tim Peake has been the most fantastic ambassador for this sector and for the whole space field and space science. I first met him when I was Minister for Life Science, and I didn't realise, but in that Principia mission, he was the human body at the heart of 23 experiments. And he told me that astronauts lose their eyesight, macular degeneration, it repairs when you come back. Pretty interesting to know why. Similarly, bone density. I think astronauts lose bone density and then gain it when they get back. This is phenomenal insight into mechanisms. So he's been a brilliant ambassador, but I think we need to inspire another generation. And it's just wonderful that we've got Rosemary as our lead astronaut. She will go to space. You know, that's very exciting. And John McFall flying the flag for disability in space. I mean, he's a remarkable young man. And to hear him speak about how space is the ultimate frontier, everything you do in space, you have to do better, cheaper, quicker, faster, with less energy, with less everything. It's a testbed, an ultimate testbed of technology. Well, his point is it's also an ultimate testbed of humanity. And it's very inspiring. We've been a great leader in disability rights. So the fact that we have the first disabled astronaut is hugely exciting.
They are all scarily brilliant, aren't they?
Yeah, they're the people you hope weren't your brother or sister when you were a child at school. They're winners at everything they do.
It's really interesting, actually, with talking about disabilities in space. I interviewed Luca Parmitano, Italian astronaut, and he said when he was in space, actually, his legs were just useless. He would have really liked to have had four arms. That would be the best thing.
Yeah, but he's also another at the ESA Council. You know that. These incredible astronauts sort of in their blue suits sort of scattered around. And they're pretty humbling. I mean, these are, they're very, very phenomenal human beings. Athletes, scientists, engineers, all in one. And I think it's just wonderful that another generation will have a chance to step in their shoes.
And potentially a UK flag on the moon.
Yeah. I know all the focus has been on Mars and on the deep science, but we do think the moon is, in this next phase, is going to become a really important sort of base station for exploration. And actually, you know, lunar science and lunar technology and thinking of the moon as a launching off point for so many other operations is a really exciting sector in itself. And as I said earlier, you know, these are very conscious here. There's a cost of living crisis. We're all paying the price for the pandemic, for the war in Ukraine. Energy costs, you know, people are really struggling. And I, as Minister for Space, feel a very strong responsibility to justify this money. And if people felt that it was all kind of, playboys doing space tourism, and if that was all it was about, I think there'd be quite a lot of concern that this was a bad use of money. But when you explain to people what we're doing and that space is the ultimate testbed laboratory, it's in space that we're defining new models of fuels, new models of recycling material science, of oxygen, of all of the kind of those technologies that are absolutely crucial to net zero, crucial to delivering more from less, to understanding nutrition and agri-tech and how you grow. All of that, it's an ultimate laboratory, people understand. And then they're inspired by the deep science and excited by the technology. And, you know, in the UK, the space economy isn't all in Cambridge or London. Spaceport, Cornwall, Surrey, satellites, Stevenage. South Wales, Space Forged, Glasgow Manufacturing, Scotland launched. This is an economy that's creating jobs all around the UK in areas that have felt a bit left behind. So I think it's a brilliant sector.
Now, none of this is going to be possible if we can't sort out the mess of what's going on in orbit at the moment with space debris, the increasing problem of space debris. You have to, launching a satellite, you have to navigate through these bands around. If you're starting to send, you've got astronauts on the space station, you're sending astronauts to the moon, increasing concern. And again, this is something that, you know, even if you look at this objectively, the UK is taking a lead on of trying to do this. How do you do it, though, without international agreement? Because that's the problem here, isn't it? There's no one. It's just free for all, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we've seen a bit of a sort of Wild West in space, and no one's been thinking too much about sustainability. It's been all about military and then geopolitical sovereignty. We are absolutely determined to make sure that the world doesn't repeat the mistakes we made in other sectors in space, and that we should, you know, leave no trace. If you're putting a satellite up there, you need to be able to demonstrate that you can manage it up there, maintain it up there, service it up there, refuel it, charge it up there, and get it back. We cannot go on littering space with debris for the reasons you've just said. Firstly, it creates hugely dangerous, damaging, and expensive clutter. So we're undermining the whole commercial economy. Secondly, if we're going to treat space as the new frontier for investigating planetary sustainability, we better practice what we preach as we go there. And thirdly, in order to really understand how to develop more sustainable models on Earth, we need to use space as the testbed for all of that. So for all those reasons, as well as the moral reason that we need to be the responsible global citizens, we are determined to use... look, we're a small country, but I think the British flag all around the world, the Union Jack, represents standards. We are a great regulator. We set the international maritime standards. We do insurance standards. We do all around the world. People look to the UK as a place that sets standards. So I've made very clear that we are going to use our Brexit freedoms. So this is an area where we've got regulatory freedom. And what I want to do is, and I announced this last summer, we're going to use that freedom to create in the UK a regulatory framework for small commercial satellite launch companies that makes the UK a really attractive place. If you're compliant with a very basic set of just best practice, we're going to start small, work with industry, set out some basic metrics that everyone would say, well, that's good practice, not just chucking junk up and leaving it. Then we'll help you with quicker licensing, cheaper insurance, easier access to finance. I think there's an opportunity for the UK to convene with other countries like Canada and Switzerland and Norway and Japan and Australia, who've all got good space economies, but they're not part of the kind of Russia, China, America bloc, a sort of space, safe space club, a clean space club, and just begin to set some international standards so that we change the assumption about this sector. And I think industry want it. They want to know the rules. And as this commercial sector takes off, I think, you know, as long as we're on the front foot setting the standards, I think we'll find the industry will come with us. As long as it isn't some sort of dramatic cliff edge that if you're not compliant with some arbitrary set of metrics within 12 months, you'll be banned. It's not about that. It's about setting the standards so that, just as when the first cars drove up and down, there wasn't an MOT. But quite quickly, people worked out it'd be quite good to have an MOT. I think we'll be in a similar situation with space, and it'll be, is your satellite retrievable? Is it serviceable? Can you get it back? Can you get it out of orbit if it's, so it doesn't become an interference? But also space traffic control. We're going to have a system where all these satellites can be properly controlled. So this is a growing industry as well as, a moral mission.
You're not going to get Russia on board for obvious reasons, but what about China here? Because they're a growing space power. Can you get them on board with some sort of international regulation? I mean, they are forming, creating space debris.
Yeah, look, I think in the end, we'll see where this whole tension, geopolitical tension, the sort of the global race between China and the West, really, which is what we're seeing, how it plays out. I mean, there are doomsters who say, you know, this is the new Cold War, and it's going to get hot, and it's defining, and we've been asleep at the wheel in the West, and we've... there are others who say, look, in the end, China is coming out of a period of geopolitical kind of insularity. It's becoming a major global player, and we will all have to work with China, and China will change, and it will adopt. And in 50 years, people will say, God, do you remember when they were the sort of big, dangerous player? And I think the truth is probably there's a bit of both. We have to be quite tough about some rules, but equally quite open-eyed about the fact that a major culture, civilization, and country is coming out into the world and wants to do science and technology and innovation. And in the end, as one planet, one humanity, we're going to have to work together. And I think science is a force for good in that. I mean, there's a high geopolitical tensions, obviously, but as science minister, I think my job is to do everything I can to nurture a sort of common, shared, global commitment to scientia, to science and technology done within decent rules.
And so will you, for example, talk to your Chinese counterparts or try and build bridges with the, you know, people in the countries that are not cooperating at the moment?
Well, China's the hard one. Right now, we're in a very difficult situation, way above my pay grade. But, I mean, you only have to read the papers, right? So I'm starting with natural allies, countries who have a very strong interest, like us, in the commercial space sector, are really worried about debris, want to make a difference. And I think if the countries I've listed and one or two others get together and we agree some basic standards and we insist that everyone should abide by them and we integrate our insurance markets, I think we'll see that the commercial space sector, as opposed to the sort of sovereign military space sector, the commercial sector will want rules. And consumers want rules. Investors want rules. And I think, actually, good regulation is good for innovation.
Just finally, you must be pretty excited about the next few years in space. Just, you know, having been a part of this now, whether you're in government or not in government,
yeah,
in
yeah.
2, 5, 10 years' time, there's quite a lot to look forward to. And do you think people are getting that the UK does space now? Because you used to hear this sort of, you know, the UK doesn't really do space, or NASA does space, UK doesn't do space. Mm. Do you feel quite positive about that?
I feel incredibly positive and very privileged to be the minister with responsibility for space. And I think in some ways, part of my job as a politician, yes, it's the regulatory piece and the policy framework, but it's also to tell the story. And I think, inspire people, not in a daft way. I mean, I think children are naturally inspired by space. It's a very inspiring thing. I think what people really need to know here is that this is key to their everyday lives, that when they pick up their phone, turn on their telly, drive their car, take a flight or a, you know, most of the communication systems controlling them are controlled through space. When they stargaze at night and see satellites, most of them aren't spying on them. They're commercial satellites, right? And I think people are beginning to realize this is not some sort of remote, distant, esoteric playground. Is absolute line one of today's economy, creating jobs all around the country. And I think that is key in this country at the moment. People are concerned about cost of living and recession. But I have an incredibly privileged job, right? I get to see stuff you see. It's incredibly exciting. And I do think, you know, Britain, we have an opportunity as we emerge from a pretty terrible decade, right? Financial crash, austerity, terrible Brexit referendum, 2 MPs murdered, political logjam, prime ministers resigning, a pandemic and a war. I think we're on the cusp now of a golden era in which people will look back and say the UK then became, again, what we used to be in the 50s and 60s, a science and technology engineering powerhouse, helping to export the technologies around the world for sustainable development in the oceans, in space, driving a common framework of science for global good, attracting billions of inward investment, and making people proud of Britain, a small country, but with a big impact. And no sector better embodies that than space. So I think it's incredibly exciting. Next year, I hope to go down to the British Antarctic Survey, who I'm responsible for, I'm not, I just want to announce, I'm not intending to go into space, but I do think it's an incredibly exciting sector. And when the Rosalind Franklin rover starts drilling into the surface of Mars, I think a whole generation are going to be electrified again.
Nice list there of all the horrors of the last 10 years.
I mean, we both started giggling then, because it's only when you hear it all lists sort of the thing out.
It was pretty bad.
Yeah. And what I found interesting as well is, you know, he talked about all the different prime ministers and the resignations and what have you. I thought it was interesting that when he resigned in July 2022 as life sciences minister, one of many MPs who resigned, which sort of toppled or forced Boris Johnson's hand effectively, the Science Media Centre put out a sort of, you know, a scientist comments. And so quite a few of them were all really sorry to see him resign, because they saw him as a good minister for, you know, for life sciences. So a lot of science people and space were quite pleased to see him promoted, or not necessarily promoted, but come back as science minister with responsibility for space, because he does seem to, as we've heard, understand the issues incredibly well, knows what's from the business side and the economy side, the value of space, but also, I mean, you can't fake enthusiasm, I don't think, anyway. I think you could normally tell the people.
Oh, no, he was.
The people who are faking it usually say, I'm really excited, and go a bit too over the top. Yeah, through normally.
He was you could tell, very personable. Yeah. Impressive knowledge. Obviously, he'd read his briefs, but the fact that he was across all this.
Not all politicians, read their briefs.
Do not read it. You know, but he was across this. He understood the sector and was, you can clearly hear, very enthusiastic. He was very keen to be on a podcast, which I thought
was fabulous.
Which is great, you know. So
I also thought the China stuff was quite interesting. Obviously, you recorded this shortly before.
Yes,
spy balloons or what have you over China. So I wonder if his opinion has changed, or whether he's still optimistic. And it's a valid point to say, you know, that today's air quote enemy, or, you know, sort of is tomorrow's friend, effectively. You never quite know which way. And all it takes is an election to change, or a referendum like Brexit to change the political landscape. And it's interesting to note that he was a Remainer. You know, he did want to stay in Europe. He was one of those.
He
enemies.
Did. He wrote quite a lot about that before the Brexit vote. I do quite like, there's a couple of nice phrases in that. I like the electromagnetic emotional energy, which I thought was really nice, really nice turn of phrase there. But also, I like this idea of this clean space club. You know, so a group of nations that gets together and says, right, we're not going to tolerate more debris. Mm. We're going to do something about it. Because, frankly, if someone doesn't start taking the initiative and do something about it, we're just going to carry on as we are.
And which, also with Starlink now, there are so many more potential pieces of debris as well, because all it takes is one not to work and maybe go into the wrong orbit or what have you. So yeah, it's a valid point.
It is, yeah. So no, it was all good. I enjoyed the interview very much, and hope you did listening to it as well. That is Space Boffins. We're kindly supported by the UK Space Agency.
And we'll be back next month, or maybe later this month, or maybe in 6 weeks' time, because
we're going to try and
we're
do it
space
later
boffins
this month.
And we're all over the place, yes, and we stretch the meaning of a monthly podcast.
And you're off to see the Orion, the service module.
I am. I'm popping to Bremen in Germany to see the ESM, the European Service Module, which is the crucial part of the Artemis missions in order to get the Orion spacecraft around the moon, to the moon, on the moon. So,
and you'll get to see them being built.
I will, yeah. So I'm not sure which number this one will be. It might be three, because they've already delivered one and two, I think three. So this, you know, who knows which number it is. But yes, that will be great to see. I will be getting quite a few interviews while I'm there, a lot of them for a series that you and I are about to do, a written series for, should we say who it's for?
Yeah, for BBC
for
Future.
BBC Future. But yeah, hopefully some of those interviews we'll do for the podcast as well.
Yeah.
Yay.
The only other thing I wanted to mention, had an email from ESA. There's a new ESA logo, or rather there isn't. All they've done is a new ESA patch. And I mean, this is to celebrate. Mm. Slovakia is now an associate member of ESA. So ESA's grown now. So it's a new patch with the Slovakian flag, which is all very nice.
Great.
Can I just say, though?
Are we not going to rant about the ESA bit again,
yeah,
are you?
You know, there's such an opportunity to, you know, NASA have embraced the old worm now. You see the nice worm logo on there. I think that was on Orion, wasn't it, the worm logo? You certainly see it on a lot of the NASA missions now, which I think is fantastic. ESA, it's got two E's in it, but it has its E-ESA.
ESA,
ditch one of the ESA.
ESA, yeah. Yeah, yes.
Look at the ESA logo. It makes no sense.
You think they should remove an E?
There's an extraneous E in the ESA logo.
Okay, they do some cool sort of patch and logo things.
Yeah,
they do great artwork.
I've got one of their Jupiter shirts. I've got a Solar Orbiter T-shirt. I mean, I bought a lot of the projects. But
the T-shirt. Yeah,
but the basic logo needs some work.
ESA. Yeah, I mean, I like the E. I agree with you. It should just be E. S-A and not have an extra
E-E-S-A.
Now we've said that, take a look and you'll see what we mean, because you'll probably just think, what on earth are they going
have
on
a look
about?
At the
it
ESA
doesn't
logo,
say
and there are too many E's.
But there is an extra
too many E's,
E's
in
an
ESA.
Extra E.
Yeah. Anyway, rant over.
Space E.
Space
Boffins.
E. Yeah. Thanks for listening.